and the government will tax an entity to increase the price of doing something to better reflect the marginal social cost of doing that. Now, that's hard to predict where that's going to be, but think of it this way. If you're running a coal-burning power plant...
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach-churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening.
I'll text you later, Kyle. I love it.
Yeah. We're recording now, okay?
Okay, good.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the China Shop over the Band of Traders podcast. My name is Kyle, and joining me tonight, I've got Bear Goes Long and another special guest in Eric Mason, our China Shop's chief economist. Now, since we keep seeing tariffs in the news, we thought it might be a good idea to bring in the closest thing to an expert that we can find.
Which is pretty far away.
Look, I will say you're the highest ranking person who responded to any of my inquiries.
Thank you.
This is also likely President's Day when people are listening to this. So I figure this also would be a really good time to get you in to maybe talk about a little project that we've been working on. The buck starts here.
Ooh, the buck start here. Very good. Yes, I'm a big fan of the buck stuff here. Turn it every week to see Eric wearing different West Virginia shirts he owns.
Wait, is that a thing?
I just started. Oh, okay. Yeah, I've been fairly different West Virginia every time. Because I haven't bought a new t-shirt in 7 years.
Yep. Nice. I'm the same way.
It's been a fun project. We have a lot of fun talking about my hatred of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison's epilepsy. And I think Abigail Adams is about it. Have we released Abigail Adams yet?
That should be going out on Monday, actually.
Yeah, Abby was. That was a fun. I think that was the funnest episode.
I really want to do like another like two or three more of those.
Yeah, she's endlessly interesting. Like her whole life is interesting, and she's a complete boss, and is actually the best founding mother and first lady of all time.
I still need Abigail's email from Fidelity.
No, I don't know what that is. I assume you're just going to email Abigail at Fidelity and just see what happens.
I'm going to give it a shot. We'll see if she wants to come and talk to us.
Do you guys remember the episode of The Office where Brian's like, yeah, I've been emailing with John Legend. I'm like, you've been emailing with John Legend? And he's like, yeah, a lot of these people are just like John Legend at, you know, apple.com. I don't know if it's John Legend, but it's so funny that.
I assume it would have been Jim, but I guess not.
Bear, I like how you keep disappearing into your background.
My cheap little AI background.
It's the Back to the Future blur system they've got.
It's kind of sick. I like it. I feel like you're going to give us wisdom and then fade off into the back, come back every so often with more wisdom. I'm a fan.
I'm afraid he needs to go get his parents to go kiss or something.
Oh, man.
It is Valentine.
Yeah, did everybody have a good Valentine?
Yeah, day? I was going to say, you know, you didn't mention what day we're recording this, and it's like, oh, hey, it's Friday night. Yeah.
If anyone's wondering where Baba is, that's what's going on. Yeah, it's Valentine's, yeah. And we're the only D-gens who, his wives go to bed early, I think.
Yeah, Tiff's like usually asleep like wicked early. She's like, I hate sleep. I go to sleep like 2 hours after Tiff, and I wake up like an hour and a half early. Sleep is the cousin of death.
Oh, see, I'm the opposite of my wife. My wife goes to bed early, gets up ridiculously early. I go to bed late and get up late.
Yeah, I used to be a sleeping guy. Then I was like, oh my God, you want to hate being unconscious, lying? I think it's because I don't really dream. So I think that's the problem. I find sleep to be a waste of time.
You don't dream.
Yeah, no, maybe like 3 or 4 dreams a year I can remember. I'm sure I dream. I just don't remember it, so I don't care.
I know we're supposed to talk about economics at some point, but now that we talked about dreaming, I got to tell you about the deep dive I went into on lucid dreaming, trying to figure out how to like actually be awake during that. And you can do it. I've done it. Cool. It's yeah. Wild. It is.
Are you
wild.
Tired when you wake up, or is it like refreshing? Do you still feel like you slept?
For the only time I ever actually managed to like become conscious during it was like one of those weird. Like sleep awake moments where you like your body like kind of like releases this chemical that like paralyzes your body like right before you're about to fall asleep. And that's the thing that keeps you from like falling out of bed or any of that shit, right? So if you there's times where like you probably felt the panic of like something happens, a loud bang, and you can't move, and like there's this like terrifying like something's happening but I can't move, paralyzed, and I feel like paralyzed. It's because I'm terrified.
Paralysis.
That's the sleep paralysis. And you're actually dreaming at that point. The sound you heard was in your head.
Terrifying.
So that was the moment where I was able to like snap up and like wake up and like realize like, oh shit, I'm dreaming right now. And then try to start controlling it and then lose complete control of it. And then terrifyingly wake up like 30 seconds later.
Yeah, it sounds horrible.
Yeah, I quit doing it after that.
I have a reoccurring nightmare.
Yeah.
Where I'm late for my Econ 201 class. Which is a class I teach now. I'm not late teaching it. I mean, I'm still in college.
As a student.
Oh, and it's funny because you think that I had an insane score in Econ 201. I finished like well above 100 average. So I have no bad memory of like, oh, I messed up Econ 201. My teacher was awesome. It was a super fun class. It clearly worked because it's like what I went to school for 6 effing years to do. So it's clearly something I like. So I don't know why I have such negative anxiety. Like, I never missed a test in college. I never had anything like that. So I don't know where this anxiety comes from. I also have this part of that same dream is that I forget I'm taking a class. Like, I'll be like, oh, like I have this dream where I'm like, I'm on like a campus and I'm like, oh, I haven't got a history class in like,
oh, I've had that dream.
7 weeks.
I've had that dream. Yeah.
Oh, that's scary because you had nuclear submarines involved in your life.
I had that dream, but not even in school. Like, just like, oh shit, I got a class and nothing. I'm not even in school.
No, I mean, I've had like the dream like that like 3 weeks ago. And yeah, again, I showed up to every class. I didn't skip stuff. I was a nerd. I loved learning. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. Like, I just go listen to like wicked smart people tell me things. It sounds awesome. Why aren't more people excited about this?
Wildest dream I ever had was in boot camp. It was like one of the first weeks we were there. And I swear to God, I heard the drill instructors come in and start waking everybody up. And like when they wake you up, you get up, you put your boots on, you stand at attention in front of your rack, and then you wait for them to give you whatever your orders are. So I pop out of bed, I throw my shoes on, I'm standing up next to the rack at attention, and I'm looking around, and it's pitch black. And the night watch is just staring at me with a flashlight pointing at me. He's like, what are you doing? Dude, what time is it? It was 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, nice. See, that's too early.
Yes.
For it to be that. Like, if it was 3 a.m., it'd feel more normal.
I went to bed, like, probably 10 minutes earlier.
Oh, that's wow. Weird.
Right?
Yeah, I love that. Oh, I'm a fan.
All right. Well, let's talk about some terrorists. How about...
Wait, we can't just talk about dreams? Dude, we could do 2 hours on dreams and be hilarious, and you know that, Kyle?
I know we could, but I actually do have some terror
questions. What kind of dreams did the
founders
have?
What is it?
I said, what kind of dreams did the founders have?
Oh, God. Yeah.
But it's such wicked sensitive, so I can hear Bear say that.
Right.
So I got like I started laughing way earlier than that. What's going to sync with the audio on that?
Don't worry. Okay. All right. Let's talk about some tariffs here now.
Yeah.
All right. So most recently, what Trump was wanting to tariff Canada and Mexico 20%. He started to do that. He announced it over the weekend. I'm guessing the market reaction kind of spooked him off of that, and he pushed it out for another 30 days. What is the reason for wanting to tariff Canada, and why such an excessive amount?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is it's a negotiation tool. So, Kyle, you and I did a cool show maybe like a month and a half ago, just, you know, talking about not the action of tariffs, but just tariffs as a principle.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when I did my 2025 outlook at the end of December or mid-December, tariffs are a huge part of that presentation. And it's funny, I'm going to say the same thing to you two gentlemen as I said to that group, which is that we don't know what's going to happen with tariffs. So I said, like, you know, we're going to, and I'm going to do the same thing for this show because we're going to stay well clear of politics on here. I can merely give you the tools to understand how tariffs work, how tariffs function. And then, you know, we can apply that through some pretty generalized models and what we can think happened. But to jump to your point, Kyle, because you brought up a good point, it's like, what's the purpose? What are you trying to do? Right. Now, in the case with the most recent actions, you know, it was used as a negotiation tool to beef up border security, essentially. And, you know, some of the stuff in Canada was signed, I think, in like mid-December to boost the border. But now there's like an opioid czar. You know, you look at what's going on in California, Mexico, New Mexico, Arizona, and stuff like borders down on the southern border. It's a little different. Mexico's president, she was, you know, I think it's been more difficult for Mexico to counter rhetoric, and that's because Mexico is just a larger trading partner than Canada. And there's always awkwardness when you have a global south, a developing economy. What we call the global south now. And then you have the global north, which is a developed economy, trading with each other. There's less parity because there's less, like, Mexico isn't going to import Teslas. I don't think most Teslas are made here. I think they're mostly made in China now. I think, but they're not importing high-value goods.
So when it's being said that there's a massive trade deficit between us and Canada or us and Mexico, I mean, I think you said it before, that's to be expected. I can't get upset that Joe Rogan doesn't listen to more of my podcast than I listen to of his, right?
Yeah, you have a trade deficit with Joe Rogan.
Yes, I do. A massive one.
Tariff Joe Rogan?
Yeah. Can I?
Yes. No, and that's the thing. Like, we're the richest country on earth. You know, it's funny. How big is the U.S. economy? How big? Let's play a game here. If the two largest economies, Germany and China, combined, and we had a new country called Chimony, and then the U.S. lost its biggest state population and GDP-wise, California, the difference between the new Chimony economy and California less USA would be the difference of the South Korean economy. the entire South Korean economy fit in that.
Oh, South Korea. Right.
What was the other crazy one that you gave us too? Like, the U.S. could lose how many states? Like 15 states?
Oh, yeah. If the U.S. separated, 26 of the 50 largest economies would be U.S. states. Like, it's one of my favorite things in class I get to do is, you know, you sit down with, I'm very lucky. I teach a lot of freshmen. I teach a lot of dual enrollees. I teach a lot of, like, people who this is the first time really getting involved in economics. And, you know, talking to kids is just about, like, how big the U.S. economy is, because we have no scale. You know, China's nominal GDP for this year by IMF forecast is, like, going to be, like, 19.8 trillion. The U.S. is going to be over 30 trillion. Like, that's crazy. That's a 10 trillion. They can combine forces with any other economy on Earth, and they're not going to reach us. So just the purchase power parity and just the ability to buy more, we can just buy more. And we also have a strong currency. Like, you're going to create trade deficits when you have a strong currency. And we don't just have a strong currency. We have the strong currency. We have the reserve currency. Like, it's beginning trade deficits. I mean, if you want to weaken the U.S. dollar to the peso, that would help the trade deficit. I mean, but I don't know if I want to, like, suddenly destroy the value of the U.S. dollar to make avocados less competitive to buy because my dollar would be getting less avocado. Like, tariffs are very weird because once you follow them to the end, you're like, why did I do that? Why did I made nothing better.
I think there's another way you can reduce trade deficits, and that's by sending less over there too, right? Like, we could stop
buying
as much, or stop importing as much. Wait.
Yeah, if we No, that would increase the trade deficit.
We import more than they buy, yes.
Than they buy, yes. So,
man, trade deficits are weird.
Yeah, everything's... Oh, yeah, that's one of the funny things. Everything in trade is just changed the sign.
Backwards.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, okay. And, obviously, you guys know me. I read a lot of news and listen to a lot of news. And it is very funny. Like, the freight... You can tell, like, what guy got put on this story.
Yeah.
Who, like, doesn't have a background and never took an econ class. Because, like, the terminology, they, like, straight up, it's just, like, you can tell they're, like, rolling the dice. Like, I hope I use that word right.
I'm just going to throw this word out here because it's, you know, it's a 50-cent word, so it makes me sound educated.
Yeah. It was, like, me trying to pronounce vehemently last time we recorded.
I still can't pronounce that word.
Laura corrected me after she was listening to it. Are you trying to say vehemently? Yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah, double E consonant, it screws with me, that E-H-E.
Like, I didn't have friends as a kid. I read a lot. Everything I heard was in my head. I didn't get to hear people telling me how things were pronounced. I had to sound it out.
I did speech therapy for like 7 years.
That would probably help.
Yeah, it actually did. I can do it, honestly, cards on the table. Like, you could barely understand me talking. Like, my brother used to have to, like, translate for me if we were, like, went out to, like, the 99. Ooh, is that a Wicked regional reference? You guys have, you don't have 99s?
Nope.
Yeah? No, that is a Wicked regional. I'm proud. You know what? I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that reference. So we go to, like, 99, which is, like, I don't know, like, better Gretzky. Applebee's.
Oh.
Wait, what is that? What
is it, like, that? Gretzky's?
What is Gretzky's?
99. The great one.
Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. No, first off, a Gretzky themed sports bar. Sign me up. Love hockey.
Right? Yeah.
But no, it's like a Uno's. Is Uno's? That's a net.
Yeah, that's a Chicago one.
Uno's is nationwide.
Yeah. So think of like Uno's, but no pizza, but like actually pretty good food. But a chain. I just described like every chain. Whatever. Ruby Tuesdays. Ruby Tuesdays. That's what
I'm saying. Is it like a Chili's?
Yeah, it's like just, I got food poisoning. I used to go to Chili's like all the time. Like one of the first times Tiffany and I went out together, it was to Chili's when we were in college, and I got food poisoning there once. Like it was before I bought my house, so this is like 7 years ago, and I haven't gone back to Chili's yet. And I used to go there like once a week, dude. I was the number one Chili's consumer in the Northeast by far. I think I hit the stock price. I just want to be honest.
See, I think me and my friends almost ruined Applebee's when we were kids because they used to always love going there for the riblet baskets they used to do. Oh, yeah, and they would demolish those things.
Dude, this is a good choice.
Fridays was more my speed, but yeah.
Fridays? Yeah.
Yeah,
Fridays is a good pick. It's higher quality beer.
Yeah.
They put cheese sticks there too, I think.
So when I was in college, I bartended at Uno's. Sick. And we closed at 10, and so at 10:30, when we were done cleaning the bar, we'd go across the street to Fridays until 2.
Yeah.
Okay, did you guys know what Fridays originally was? I just found this out like a month and a half ago.
Does it have to do with Robinson Crusoe?
No, but why does that feel like that could be a great random trip? If I was like at a trivia place.
I would try to pass that off as fact in my group. Right? Yeah. Well, it's because Man Friday is his servant.
Yeah. But, that'd be a good random fake fact.
Fake facts? Nice.
No, it was a singles bar. It was a singles bar that was so popular, they used to have to shut down streets in Lower Manhattan. If you have a chance, like, Google the history of Fridays, and you're going to be like, what? This used to be the top singles bar. And it was like, they would shut places down, and then everybody started stealing that decor. But basically, at the time, there was, like, pubs people would eat at. And then there was bars, like, friends and shit would go to. And somebody's like, there's no place for singles people to go. This is like the early 70s. And so the guy who founded Fridays was like, I'm going to make this like, even you think about, well, before they redid the interiors of Fridays, like what, almost a decade ago now, before that, remember it had like the weird lamps and like really 1970s vibe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually like when it was made, that was like the, you know, the hot stuff to have in there. And it was like crazy. It was this crazy singles bar in like New York. I found that awesome.
So it was intended to be like a pickup club, basically.
Yeah. And then now it's like you go there with your family because you're like, ooh, I want to get some mozzarella sticks.
Is that the one that like Eddie Murphy and his brother used to hang out at all the time?
Yeah.
It was the one where, what's his name? I got slapped in the face.
Will Smith.
So
Rick, no.
Oh, Chris Rock. Chris Rock.
Chris Rock. No, Chris Rock. Rick James, bitch.
Rick James. The yeah. best Chappelle.
With five fingers say to the face.
Slap. So, somebody was, I think where I saw it, but somebody shaved the, when they're playing basketball, the Charlie
Murphy
story.
Oh my God, those are so good.
He's like, shoot the ball. It's the best like fake Rick James voice of all time.
I haven't seen Chappelle's Show since it was originally on. Wow. I need to go back and watch it.
Oh, again. It's so good.
It holds up.
Yeah, even the first Key and Peele episodes, like, man, those are still pretty fun.
Yeah, no, they're absolutely hilarious.
All right.
So tariffs.
Tariffs. Yeah,
so
tariffs.
Okay, so right now we went through this like 2-decade process of basically offshoring a significant chunk of our domestic auto production to Mexico.
Yes.
But I feel like in a lot of that still, we manufacture a lot of the subcomponents in the U.S. and then we ship everything to Mexico for final assembly for some bizarre reason and then ship the completed vehicle back.
Yeah, I mean, Canada also has a large portion of our manufacturing base. So we assemble the really technically advanced pieces of the car. The way I think about it is that, you know, you don't go to your doctor's if you want to, you know, get your nails done. Your doctor could give you a, what's it, manicure? Is that hands? Manicure?
Yeah, manicure.
Yeah. That could do that, but it'd be a pretty expensive bill. You know, if you have to stay overnight in Boston, you bet it's cheaper to get a hotel than stay at Mass General because there's larger capital and technical investments. So we ship that back over to Mexico or up to Canada because it's just cheaper to assemble. What we're trying to do with trade is maximize the return of every dollar equal to some form of production. So if you send something down to Mexico where, you know, you're talking about a median income that's a fifth, a sixth, a seventh, a tenth in some areas of Mexico of the U.S., you can get that same car assembled for such a cheaper price. And at the end of the day, what's really going to happen is that people want cheaper cars.
Yeah.
Like, that's what forces the economy of scale there, is that people just want mm-hmm. cheaper cars. And they can get cheaper cars by using cheaper labor. But here's the cool thing. People think trade, and this is the thing that pisses me off a lot, is that there's only one economic system that doesn't require poverty, and that's capitalism. And that people get surprised when you say that. But here's why trade is fascinating. So, it's in my other room. So I finally broke down and bought a Nintendo Switch like I'm a 6-year old. So I have a Nintendo Switch Lite because I can play all like the old NES and N64 games on them.
GoldenEye.
Yes, and it's 100% worth every penny. I highly suggest buying it.
We have a Switch, but I don't know if we have the mini one.
It's awesome. You can do like Nintendo Store Play or something. I got to still work it out, but I'm having fun. That's all I'm saying.
I know. I need to go get Tecmo Bowl. That's what I need.
Tecmo Bowl. That'd be fun as shit. I want that, right? I want to pay $100, and I paid like $175 for everything for it, which is still crazy. You can basically buy like a handheld supercomputer for like, I don't know, like... Mm-hmm. Which I think a nice steak dinner out with like three dudes is like how much, and I was like, oh, I can have infinite hours of play on this supercomputer. So why is that so cheap? It's because of components. If I made it all out of titanium, or I made it all out of the base material needed for the processor, it's going to become more expensive. Mm-hmm. So we cost optimize down when we produce things to its cheapest possible form. And part of the production function is the labor input. And so if you can cost down labor input. Now, here's where it gets interesting, how everybody can benefit. So I'm in the United States. We have the most capital. Okay, so you have marginal product of labor. That's how much more things can be produced by adding one more person. And what we do, how we measure that, is how much capital is behind each individual. How many tools does an individual have to be able to produce more? So if you have a lot of capital behind you, you have a lot of investment behind you, you need to be making high-value decisions. You need to be able to make it high value production, I should say. Now, the U.S. would do that through very, very, very intensified actions, such as financial services. But we also do it in our biggest export, which is agricultural goods. The U.S. exports produces an insane amount of agricultural goods. We're able to have way less farmers and way more production of agricultural products because of technology, because of capital behind people. Well, in the United States, capital is... We just have way more capital than other countries because we have such high rates of return. It leads to high income. High income leads to reinvestment. We don't have that, you know, our Gini coefficient definitely leans more to the inequality side than, say, in Europe, where it's on the more of an equal footing. That just begets more investment, more money flowing throughout the economy. 18% of our economy is investment, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so I can take my time, right? Time's finite. 1 hour to Eric is the same as 1 hour to anybody else in the world. 1 hour to an American worker is the same as 1 hour to a worker in Mexico. So that we have this thing called the Lewis model. It won a Nobel Prize in the 60s. Sir Arthur Lewis won it. And basically, it's called dual sector economics. So you take somebody who's working a farm in Mexico, and you say to him, all right, farm production with a little bit of capital behind you, is not, you're not making that much money. Like the amount of production, your pay is based on production, mm-hmm. you're making is not that high.
When you say the capital behind him, you're talking about like the equipment he has. Like he doesn't have a $100,000 combine harvester. He's got probably a goat and a plow.
Yeah. That gentleman, you say, you walk over to him and say, hey, you can take your hour of time and come work in this factory and you're going to assemble Nintendo Switches. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, that's going to be more productive at a higher rate of return. So he goes and works there, and suddenly he has more money. He can invest, he can buy stuff, he can consume, he can be taxed by the government. He can, but there's more things. Your GDP increases. And then Eric, or the guy who would build the Nintendo Switch for Eric in the U.S., he can be like, dude, I'm going to go build a spaceship. High rate of return on that. Like, I'm going to go do something else. So now Mexico's economy is bigger because there's a better means of production. There's a better end goal of their means of production, and then we're getting a higher rate of return, and then we just trade because you know that person got money for building that satellite. He higher value add process. He has more money. He buys his Switch, and the guy down in Mexico is like, oh my, you know, my company's growing because of this consumption, this trade with the U.S. But now you see the trade deficit because the dude in the U.S. who's building these ultra advanced things that only U.S. consumers and maybe some people in Western Europe can buy is trading with Mexico, and then somebody in the U.S. is like, I want to put avocados on everything. And he's like, I'm gonna go buy a bunch of avocados. And the guys down in Mexico, and I think Argentina produces a lot of avocados also. We're sending the money. They're sending us avocados. And we have very strong dollars. They have a very depreciated currency. The way I always describe currency depreciation in trade is take a glass bottle, right? And fill it with golf balls. That's inefficient, right? There's a lot of air, right?
Yeah.
Now try and fill it with sand. That's gonna be very efficient, right? There's not gonna be a lot of air gaps. Golf ball is a heavy currency. Sand is a weak and small currency. It's better off. That's why Vietnam devalues the dong so much, is because they're such a heavily reliant export nation that they make huge scales on having the cheapest currency on earth.
That's why a weaker dollar affects import export. Like when our dollar gets weaker, then we send more stuff. We tend to export more to Europe because it's more cost effective for them to buy it at that point.
Yeah, and so tariffs are frustrating in the sense that they ignore that economics. They ignore tariffs, generally speaking. I've never actually met an economist who's pro-tariff. And I know economists from, you know, left of Keynes to, you know, right of Hayek.
So if nobody's for tariffs, as far as economists go, then why is it when I look at the list of all the tariffs other countries have against the U.S., and I see that just about every country has a tariff against us, and some of them are pretty large, like 10% or higher.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of them go back to just protectionism. Most tariffs are almost exclusively just used for protectionism. You know, there's really three types of tariffs, right? There's punitive tariffs, you trying to punish somebody. There's protectionary tariffs, you trying to not really hurt somebody, but protect your own stuff. And then there's something we call, broadly, will be called, there's people have alternate names for it. I've always heard it called a therapeutic tariff. And that's when you have something like China flooding the electric vehicle market, and you're not really trying to just protect U.S. electric vehicle manufacturers, you're trying to adjust the market for China's intentional devaluation of their labor.
So they did this when I was in the steel industry a while ago. They I was working at a SBQ plant. They dropped like 1 million tons of SBQ in the port of Houston and just said for sale, and all our orders just disappeared.
Yep. Yeah, that would be like, in those types of tariffs, those, let's call them therapeutic tariffs for this discussion, they are really robust and do actually conform to most microeconomic interpretations. Because in microeconomics, we have this thing called, we have externalities, and we all know what externalities are. The good things and the bad things that we don't expect to happen when we do an action. Or we do expect to happen, but then happen to a third party who's not involved in the transaction, can't be compensated through exchange, or direct exchange. And we call that marginal social cost, is this concept of I do an action, or I trade with somebody else, or I engage in some sort of action, and the two primary parties can properly price what they're doing, but there's some extra effect. There is pollution, there is drain off, there is positive ones too. Education is always a very good example of a positive marginal social benefit. But let's talk marginal social cost, because that's really what matters here. And so what we can can do as consumers is try, there's something called the Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. There's a really interesting paper on lighthouses, on why most lighthouses, believe it or not, were actually privately owned in England. This whole idea of like lighthouse exchange. But what we do mostly in developed countries is we allow the government to handle that. And the government will tax an entity to increase the price of doing something to better reflect the marginal social cost of doing that. Now, that's hard to predict where that's going to be, but think of it this way. If you're running a coal-burning power plant and you are burning the coal and all that coal ash is causing acid mine drainage,
and you know there's going to be cleanup costs associated with it at some point in the future.
Yep. And if you're like me, a guy who likes to fish, and you're like, oh, and I go over to the... And I've seen this in real life. I've seen this when I was in West Virginia. And you go down to a lake and it's bleached. Well, I still want to fish. And now my marginal utility, my marginal benefit of wanting to fish is gone. So they tax that coal plant, and the government then uses that money to, you know, either clean up the river or, you know, stock fish in a pond so that people can go fish there. Like, that would be an example of adjusting for a negative externality. Now, okay. The U.S. can't, like, tax Chinese electric battery manufacturers and electric car manufacturers to adjust that marginal social cost.
Right.
But because, you know, a lot of Chinese companies are so intertwined, there's really no separation of state and corporations, the public and private sector in China. Well, you can have that same effect, essentially, by hitting them with a tariff. So that's one way to do it. But what the key here, why I would hesitate to call that a protectionary tariff, is the United States isn't saying no foreign car companies can sell electric cars in the United States. The Nissan Leaf was like the first electric car in the United States. The U.S. has no problem with that.
Right.
They're saying you can't manipulate the industry.
Yes.
So they're agnostic to it. On the flip side, aviation is an example of this, of a protectionary tariff. Is U.S. slaps tariffs on Airbus because they don't want people built, they don't want that competition with Boeing. And the funny thing is, like, Airbus actually went and, like, started building stuff in Alabama and to avoid the tariff. And at the end of the day, if you're the U.S., you're like,
cool.
Now, me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, me as an economist, like, that's an inefficiency. And I think all the people working that Airbus plant are probably like, hey, Eric, I don't give a crap about your inefficiency. My wages went up. My kids are going on vacation. And that's where I'm always like, economists sometimes need to take a step back and be like, okay, this is why people don't like us sometimes, because we're like complaining that like an American in Alabama has a better life. Like, maybe we just go, okay, you know, in a perfectly efficient world, this would not happen. But at the end of the day, I'm also not going to lecture somebody in Alabama that they should be angry about their higher paying job and better life they have.
You know, but then you pull out your tables and you compare GDP of Alabama to France and go,
Yeah.
One of my favorite ones to do is if Spain was part of the U.S., it would be the poorest state by 40% of the poorest state. So if you take Mississippi and chop it in half, you get Spain, which is also a large car manufacturing area that's actually excelling. It's actually doing a lot better, but Spain's a weird economy.
So Spain, I think you're talking
about Mississippi. They still have force quotient.
Okay, back to tariffs again.
Mississippi's a weird economy too.
So one of the other things that's been touted with this tariff plan is that somehow these tariffs are going to replace income taxes. How does that work? Is that possible?
I mean, it could. It would be a transitive tax. It would be the same thing as having a sales tax. It would be a consumption move tax.
Right.
Probably not the form, but I do like, I'm be honest with you, I do like the idea of taxing consumption and not income.
Yep.
Because I prefer people to invest, because that's what drives the economy. Not Eric Mason's opinion. Robert Solow, as in the guy who won the Nobel Prize for the Solow growth model opinion. I have no original ideas. I just read very smart economists and then regurgitate them in a Boston accent that occasionally trips over his words. That's my,
I just record you.
But no, I mean, so yeah, it would essentially become a consumption tax. So there's two different scenarios. And, you know, Kyle, we went, if anybody wants to watch Kyle and I's episode, I had some slides on it too. If you have a really, really economically insensitive demand for something, like, you know, I'm sure people who listen to this have probably mentioned before, like, I have type 1 diabetes, right? And like, if you were to tax something that somebody can't live without, like insulin, you would get no production change.
Inelastic demand, right?
Yeah, inelastic. I use the word insensitive because elasticity is a little bit of a more unique in the college instructor on me always wants to be careful of saying an elastic, because you can have a line, you can have a demand chart like this, and your elasticity is going to change at any individual point on that demand curve. But I'm referring to like the slope of the line.
Gotcha.
And a lot of people make the mistake that the pitch and slope of the line are forms of elasticity. So there's going to be some random listener who's like taking a micro class.
This sounds like the test question that we actually did.
That literally might be it.
Is that the tricky one that everyone was pissed off at?
Yes. There was a question on that exam. Yeah, that was the one you guys yelled at me. You're all insensitive. The sensitivity is different. And I'm like, you guys are mean to
that
me.
That wasn't me. That was Harvey. Harvey was very upset.
Harvey had the best exam because he got every hard question right.
And every easy question wrong.
Just, he was doing so. I'm like, great. Because like, remember, we had to put his ranking back in.
History isn't just boring names and dates. It's weird, messy, and full of what-were-they-thinking moments. The buck starts here, dives into the financial fiascos, questionable deals, and outright chaos that helped build America, $1 at a time. We mix in serious history from a fresh perspective, real, deep dives into the numbers and the moments that shaped the country, without the boring lecture. From presidential blunders to almost states, and the time an international war almost started over a pig, we break down the key events that made, and nearly broke, the nation. It's the fascinating untold history you won't find in the textbooks. Subscribe to the Buck Starts Here podcast for a deeper look at presidential history that's anything but dull.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Remember, we had to re-rank it.
Yeah.
And like, I'm going through it and I'm like, oh my God. So anything higher than 25 is insane. Like, that's like, especially if you haven't studied, or like you're just doing that as like a funny thing to do on like a Thursday afternoon if you're bored. A 25 is literally insane. I would honestly be like, did you cheat? Like, did you just like throw the, like, hey, you won the prize. I don't care. Like,
right.
Yeah, right. But like, kills the fun. And I'm grading his, I'm just like, oh my God, like he's hit, like the hardest questions, like the question bank has, is like, he's crushing it. And then it's like down the stretch, I don't know if like he gave up. I feel like he should have won. Like a little part of me is like, he should have, if we adjusted the weights for difficulty, but he decided not to do that because that would have been like impossible to do. He would have, I was really impressed. I was like, oh shit.
Well, I kind of want to just see if we can make it rescale it just to see.
We should do, when we do the show,
yeah,
like on it, I'll regrade it based on difficulty when we do the rankings.
I think he's got another side bet going with Bayless on it.
You guys did great on that. I was really impressed.
I think all of us failed the easy questions, and all of us were like nailing the practical ones.
Yeah, I think like the group for on the practical ones on the AOLs and stuff like that, you guys had to have batted over 85 on those. But then like some of them, like literally I had a question that was ranked a 1, which is like the baby question I asked to make sure the kids are conscious, I think was like a 30 in the group.
What was the question?
I forget exactly how it was worded, but it was basically like, if a supply line moves to the right and price stays the same, like what happens?
They got you know how long I spent? You know how long I spent trying to look at the graph above it, trying to figure out what the fuck I was even looking at? Because I'd never seen this graph before. I just assumed that maybe you showed it, you know, in a previous example.
No, I was. I'm like, guys, it just the price goes down. If they're selling more of something, like the price goes down.
That's the overthinking that you're. Yeah, I'm over there trying to figure out. Yeah, I overthought a lot of it.
Like in Pearson, I can see how long a student takes on a quiz, or it takes to answer each individual question. Right, yeah, so that's how you can tell if it's like the you know the sad thing you'll see students on the easiest ones spend like a minute 40, and you're always like, oh man, that's a bad rate of return on that. I couldn't see that for you guys because I always set it up. And I'm sitting there like, I would love to see how long some guys spent on some of those questions.
Dude, I would have loved to have known that too, because I got so stoned before I started taking that test. I thought maybe I wouldn't overthink it if I, you know, got obliterated first.
I'm kind of interesting because I have a pretty, I've done truckloads of certification exams over my career. So I've got a pretty strong strategy around those. And I'll literally, I have a mental timer. If I start to get stuck in a problem, I just mark it and go to the next one.
Yeah. Yep.
And then I go through the whole test and then I come back on those. Because especially like certification exams, you'd be amazed at you get totally stuck on a question. And then like five questions later is the exact same question reworded.
Yeah.
Or the answer or, you know, from a slightly different perspective, and you're like, oh, that's what they meant. Oh, boom, 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 done.
Yep. That happens so often. And then also, too, you gotta never know if you're getting a lazy grader. Because, like, if I was making a test, I'd guarantee you that answer key would spell something out.
I know. I actually go through, when my students do their exam, I will go through each individual exam afterwards. Like, you know, it's all auto-graded and everything like that.
Yeah.
Just because I don't know, I feel like that's one of the best ways. You whether you want to be or not, you're honest on an exam. Like it's so denaturizing that I love going through it. And like I'll email students afterwards, like being like, hey, let's talk about this thing. Like there's so much more data now when it comes to teaching. Like I can see exactly where students are strong, where they're weak. Like I have students who, you know, they show up to office hours a couple times in a semester and just do great. They get A's and everything. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to bother you, dude. If you're just doing a great job, there's no need to talk to me. I'm not that interesting of a guy. But what's great is that I can, like, pinpoint. And it's almost like exact therapy of where to help struggling students because there's so much data. And I don't know.
Economic acupuncture.
Dude, right? Like, it's awesome. Like, especially, like, my favorite thing is, like, I'm a talker, and I'm a pretty weird guy. I talk about economics a lot. So I'm like, you know, once you find out what the kids like, if they like baseball cards, they're into theater, whatever, it's like, economics is a great field because I can make examples of that. You can't do, like, I love accounting, but you can't do with accounting. You can't be like, oh, you like Chevelles? Like, that doesn't help with accounting. I made a couple students my office hours before my first exam. I made them go around and describe, like, their dream car to me.
Yeah,
and I was like using that in every example. I'm gonna tell you, this new generation of kids got good taste in cars. I was very, very happy.
What were you getting?
I was getting muscle cars. I was getting like crossovers. I got a couple kids with station wagons, and I was like, station wagon's a good car. Wild. I'm a team station wagon. Yeah,
do you like the
long back?
Where you are looking back at the drivers in the back seat?
Rocket seat. Yeah, dude, that's sick. Are you against the rocket seat, Kyle?
I have a completely different vacation than the rest of the family.
Terrifying.
What do all these signs say, like Brian Regan used to say?
No, I'm a big fan. No, but that'll be a fun show we do when we go back through the exam. I think it would be. I was really I'll put it this way, and I don't mean this mean. I was very much expecting you guys to kind of kill it. So I don't want you to think like I was like, oh, look, I'm so surprised I did well in it. But I was surprised how well you guys did on the insanely hard questions. Like, that cinema question is a bloodbath, usually. That question on, like, how do cinemas negotiate showing films with, like, Netflix and Hulu sitting as that third-party actor. And I think there was 100% right across the entire group. Like, I don't think anybody got that wrong.
Wow.
That one seemed like the easiest one out there.
Actually. Yeah, that's what pissed me off.
That was the one I just thought through. I was like, oh, yeah, it's got to be this.
I'm getting trash talked because, like, oh, look at your weird wording on Elastic yeah. curves. And I'm like, some dude's just like able to negotiate like a Hulu deal. And I'm like, all right, this isn't my fault. This is your fault.
I think that's kind of the interesting data point of the whole test thing, though, is that it really is just the terminology and just the book parts that I think that, I mean, I think really what we just found is that the experience for a 4-year college degree in economics is to just go out and trade for a few years.
I am a fan of Hayek. Man on the spot. Everybody's an economist.
Damn right.
Everybody's an economist. I do actually very much agree with that. Oh, Paul, I think you guys understand trade-offs. That's the other thing. Like,
every time I make a stupid decision, I hear that voice in my head of like, I know that made a lot of sense a few minutes ago, but man, it doesn't now.
I always like the meme where the bird's like, I did all the calculations of this. Too bad I'm bad at math.
Yeah, exactly.
We have Joel's questions up here. Are we doing Joel's questions?
Oh, no, those are Canadian questions. Oh. Those are tomorrow.
Okay. I'm going to say.
Like, yeah, because we're doing Canadian economics and the burning down of the White House. Monroe. Is it Monroe?
Madison. Oh,
that's right. Madison.
Close enough. So these Canadian questions, so they're slightly devalued. It's like their currency. It's a dollar, but slightly devalued.
I mean, I'm probably using the wrong terminology here, but on a more local level, is it even worth going through and trying to do an analysis and going, hey, you know, we're budgeted by X dollars of goods. Should we start breaking down and looking at, you know, hey, how many of these are potentially impacted and, you know, trying to use that to adjust our budget?
Yeah, this is a really, really good question. This gets to the heart of a lot of this. And this is a real big challenge because who imports things? Is it the government?
Not really. No. Companies and people, right?
It's companies. So do you go to every company and suddenly tell them that, like, you can only import X amount of goods? And that's called a command and control economy. That's what actually Spain kind of does that. So it becomes very anti-capitalistic very quickly, which, you know, the main leaning we have now across the world is there's a shift towards populism. So, you know, populism and capitalism don't actually get along that well. Like, they don't actually work together that well. So is that something that we may see? Like, we may see, like, a import quota? Bear, you're 100% right. That would really get rid of a trade deficit. My argument's always been, why? I don't care about trade deficits.
Yeah.
Something I saw pretty funny recently. Somebody was talking about how the U.S. imports a lot of food. And so somebody stupidly drew the conclusion, like just dumb, no thinking, oh, the U.S. doesn't make enough food. And I read an article, they went on a rant about that. And I don't comment on news articles online because, like, something's the matter with me, but nothing. I'm not that broken yet.
Yeah.
But I couldn't help my comment. I'm like,
it's just a different flavor of masochism, that's all.
Yes.
Yeah. But I couldn't help and I commented and I was like, wait, do you think we're importing food because we don't make enough of it? No, we're importing food because we have a ton of money and we like variety.
Right.
We export more food than anybody.
We're tired of eating bananas. We want to eat kiwis.
Yes.
Probably throw away more food than most people export.
Dude, like, that's like actually probably a factual statement that, like, U.S. probably wastes more food. I think we do like something like, I looked at this, Statista did something recently on this. I think we do like $19 trillion in agriculture production, and the next closest person is Brazil at like $12 trillion, $13 trillion. It's like, oh, so the entire GDP of India is the difference between us and Brazil just on agricultural goods. Right. Like, why don't we calm down about the U.S. not producing enough calories? It's like, no, I want to eat avocados and kiwis and whatever weird fruits and vegetables that I want.
The American breadbasket's feeding most of the world, isn't it?
Yes, we are the largest exporter of agricultural goods. Mm-hmm. People just have a bad concept of just like how large and diverse our economy is. Like, that's why we mentioned earlier that random fact. It's like if the U.S. was split, if every state became its own nation, it would make up 26 of the top 50 economies. Like, it's just like, it's just wild. And so, but that's what happens. You end up with this. You end up with trade imbalances because we simply want to buy more things. You know, a great way to end trade deficits is make Americans poorer.
Yeah, that'd work.
Yeah, make the U.S. dollar weaker, make Americans poorer, and you'd get rid of trade deficits real quick. You know where there's not a trade deficit? North Korea. Actually, North Korea definitely has a trade deficit. Yeah, North Korea definitely has a trade deficit.
People.
You know what I'm saying. That was a bad example.
You know what you tried to say.
Wow.
You want to try another one?
Yeah, Vietnam.
No. There you go. Can I leave all that in before that?
You leave all that in. I thought it was pretty funny.
I like it.
Okay, so look at it from, maybe this is not a fair question, but we'll see. A really popular interpretation, at least, of tariffs is that when you have goods that are manufactured both domestically and externally, that, you know, the real effects of tariffs is they just allow the domestic producers to increase their prices and maximize their profits. And ultimately, it just hurts everybody.
Yeah, because what it also does, the way I describe tariffs is they don't protect jobs, they increase the job losses and move them to an industry that doesn't deserve it. When you put tariffs on steel, you protect steel worker jobs, but you put, you know, people who produce kegs and other things that use raw steel as their primary end product, put those people out of work and you put more of them out. But yeah, that's what you see. So what do firms do? Well, like, firms are profit seekers, right? So, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing, all right? Capitalism only works if everybody's out for their own self-interest. You can be altruistic.
Greed can be good.
Yeah.
It's when all our interests align is when greed is a powerful good thing.
Yeah, it's because it creates competition. And competition, you can't dictate human creativity, right? Like, competition, the strive to be better is a positive thing. Like, but there needs to be incentive for there to be variation to be better, right? If no matter what you do, if you're always the same, you always see the same amount of success. Well, then what's the point? I mean, it's weird we pretend that motivation isn't a thing. Like, that's always found that to be a bizarre factor. But yeah, what ends up happening is that, you know, you're like, oh, suddenly if you're the only person who's allowed to sell something, you're going to jack up the price. We have a name for it. It's called a monopoly. All you're doing is shrinking the amount of sellers. You're in most markets are oligopolistic in nature. Mm-hmm. So there's a weird thing when it comes to market creation, right? So people think you need to have a free market to have efficient pricing. And that's a way that if you're sitting in the first 8 weeks of my class, I'm probably going to say that to you. But one of the things we try and really instill in the students we have part of our curriculum is the understanding of what competition means. So there's only two companies on earth that make I'm not counting whatever Aeroflot or whatever in the CMJ series in China because they're not FAA certified and all the other stuff that make wide body jets. Right? It's us. It's Boeing in the U.S. and then it's Europe with Airbus.
So what happened to McDonnell Douglas? Did they get bought out?
Yeah, they're part of Boeing now.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Long time ago.
Yes, they are, because the MD-80, they don't make passenger jets.
Oh, okay.
Because MD-88 is the Boeing 717, I believe. It's like similar. But is a wide-body jet. Like, you have the 787, you have the A350, both primarily carbon fiber. Those are a lot more carbon fiber than the 787, but, you know, ultra efficient. Like, they're more efficient than freaking Priuses. Like, it's not like a joke. They can move like 100 people, 100 kilometers on like a liter of fuel. Like, wow. Yeah, ultra high bypass engines, the ratios are like 15 to 1. They're crazy. So, are they competitively priced? There are only two guys in the entire world who can make them. They're ultra advanced to be made. Are they the competitively priced? And the answer is probably yeah, even though it's a duopoly, because they're constantly competing with each other. They're constantly competing. And the threat of competition creates efficient pricing. In fact, you will see oligopolies price more efficiently when they're under the threat.
Yeah. To prevent another one from coming in. Yeah.
Yes. 100%. So when you have more competition laying around.
Vermont maple syrup sellers in Canada.
Yeah, yeah, the strategic Canadian reserve for maple syrup. Those, it is weird. The biggest cartel in Canada is maple syrup.
That's not weird. It's
no. I'm just talking about we're talking about tariffs to fight cartels.
Ironic. Yeah,
like I just feel like my bingo card for 2025 was in the maple syrup cartel.
One of them is a lot less scarier than the other one.
Oh, I don't know, man. I have diabetes. Maple syrup is pretty scary, man.
Okay.
It's a good joke, Kyle.
You can go down south. I'll go north and hang out with.
I will say, also being a celiac.
Oh, go down south and get killed by sweet tea.
Yeah,
I remember I had wicked low blood sugar over my in-laws' house, and I was like, "Oh my god!" So I was like, I ate Chipotle at like, I don't know what got into me. I had Chipotle at like 9:30 at night. Took an insulin shot. Then I had to go to take, then I was taking like my nighttime insulin shot. I don't know what happened. My blood sugar dropped. So I like ran, I like went into the kitchen and they had a giant thing of sweet tea. So I ended up drinking like a gallon of sweet tea to get my blood sugar back up. Because I was like, that'd be really embarrassing when the first time you go over to in-law's house, you go into, you have a hypoglycemic event.
You almost had one second dinner I think we ever had. And you got my soda. They switched up like your diet.
Oh, yeah, my blood sugar went up. Yeah, it was wild. That poor kid, I was just like, is this regular Coke? He's like, yeah. I'm like, it needs to be diet. And you can see over his face like that, like
I fucked up.
Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. What ticked me off is I couldn't eat all my tacos.
I know.
I was just angry because I'm just like staring at these tacos. I went there last. We went there last Saturday. That place is awesome. I love that place. Like, I didn't blame the kid. Right? I view that as part of the risk of me going out to eat. I view that as like if I was to make an interest cost of me going out, that would be part of my risk premium.
Hey, but I'm on the risk scale. Hyperglycemia is not as threatening and not as sudden as hypoglycemia.
Yeah. Like hyperglycemia, you're like, oh, don't do that for 10 years. Consistently,
it's territory kind of thing. It's all kinds of things. Once you start pushing into like 400 on your BGL, that's 400. We're like, yeah, you're going to the hospital. But it's not we're not turning on the sirens because it's not like you're going to die in 5 minutes. You're going to die in a few years. But
When I got diagnosed, my blood sugar was like 760, something like that. 762. Yeah, and they did put the sirens on when they drove me in.
You were like DKA territory there.
Dude, I was this height, so I was 6'4". I was 128 pounds.
What?
Wow.
Yeah. So I could take my forearm and put it over on my hip bones and stick my hand between my like top of my pelvis and my forearm and go like this and like not touch either. I was about as close to... They told me I pretty much was as close to death as you could be. So... I get diagnosed. So I'm flying down.
Wait, so you're just afraid to eat because you don't know what's making you get all jittery?
Oh, no, dude. No. So here's the thing. Like, I was eating normal. I was drinking normal. I was drinking like a lot of like Gatorade because you're thirsty all the time. But I started losing all this weight. So I'm 19. So I got diagnosed a lot later than the average person. I'm a sophomore in college. No. This would have been my first semester of my junior year. So like, it was exhausted, dude. I was like, I was peeing every 45 minutes. I could barely, West Virginia's all stairs everywhere you go. Like, because it's on the side of a mountain. It's a beautiful campus. I mean, it's like literally one of the prettiest places on earth.
The whole state.
I love the state, dude. It's fucking just wild, all stairs. Beautiful. It's the state's all stairs. That's kind of, like, honestly, not wrong.
All right.
more stairs than my Eastern Massachusetts butts used to. No, so I'm like, dude, I remember like I would have to take exams really fast because I like you pee yourself. So that goes on. And like, I'm just one of those guys like, oh, that's weird. Oh, it's just weird. I'm losing all this weight. And dude, I remember sitting up one night. It's like, because you can't sleep. Actually, I don't know. If anybody else has type 1 that's listened to this, before I got diagnosed, I had a hard time sleeping. And Ray Allen, famous guard, Celtics. His daughter has type 1 diabetes, and he did like an ad, and it was like, if you have these symptoms, I had every one of the symptoms. I'm just like, oh, that's weird. So I go
Ray
home.
Allen PSA saved your life.
So I go home, and my mom sees me, and she's just like, oh my god, because I'm just like, no bones, I'm all bones,
skin and bones.
So I go to the doctors, and they test me. So my great-grandfather was like one of the first people successfully treated for type 1 diabetes in the Boston area. Like, he was the Jocelyn Clinic. He was treated by Dr. Jocelyn, so was his brother. They both lived to be in their late 80s. So I go there. So my mom's like, mom sends me to the doctor. And earlier that year, a couple months before this, I'd got diagnosed with celiac disease. So they thought that's why I was why I was losing weight. It was funny.
Didn't
I remember they
test your blood sugar when they were checking for celiac?
No, they didn't check my blood sugar, which I thought was kind of funny. Yeah, it was.
Wow.
Good point on that, Bear, actually.
That's like 101 stuff.
Yeah.
Massachusetts I'm
might be a little behind.
Massachusetts is notoriously behind on healthcare. Notoriously not.
From the ambulance basis, when we're rolling into an ER, it's like, what do they care about? what's their pulse, what's their blood sugar, what's their pulse, what's their blood pressure, and then what's their blood glucose.
Yeah, they probably would have.
I mean, we get pinged on that, everybody.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever had my blood sugar tested at, I don't know my wife ever has. I've never seen that tested at a like emergency call.
I'm going to test your blood sugar next time I see you.
Probably should be, because I... now that you mentioned it, I pee a lot, too. I'm also tired a lot. Yeah, yeah, I do, actually, yeah. What are the other symptoms? What else I got to look out for?
Yeah, a lot of fatigue. Like, my legs burnt a lot walking, because you know, your body's not converting anything to energy. I get on the plane to leave, and they didn't send the test back yet. So I'm like, but I'm sitting there. I remember my dad's, at my dad's gas station. He's replacing a tire, like on the tire machine. I'm talking to him, and my, you know, my parents are like, what the heck's the matter? Like, you know, they're trying to figure out what's wrong with me. And, so I said to them, I was like, I probably have type 1 diabetes. My parents are like, don't say that. And I'm like, no, I'm just saying, like, I think I have that. But anyways, I fly home. I fly back to school. I land in Pittsburgh, and I don't turn on my phone until I get to my car in the parking lot. I look at my phone, I have like 100 missed calls.
Oh my God.
A bunch of missed text messages. I have like my mom text me, actually one of my best friends text me, he was actually working for my dad at the time. So he calls me and he's like, dude, he's like, you gotta go back to the terminal. You have type 1, like they think you have type 1 diabetes. So I have to go back. Dude, I don't mean to sound funny, but like I'm in the car lot, right? And you get to take like the little shuttle bus. So the guy who dropped me off is like, coming around in a circle. He sees me walk back to the little waiting area. So he picks me up and he's like, oh, how's it going? Did you forget something? And I wasn't going to tell the guy, like, no, I just found out I have like this horrible disease.
Yeah, I forgot something like, back in West Virginia.
So I was just like, oh no, I just left something in the terminal. And I'm so I go to the terminal. There's like two EMTs waiting for me. Like, are you Eric Mason? And I was like, yes. They're like, yeah, you need to you need to sit down.
Like, they called an ambulance for you?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, they probably should have. You're 119 pounds wandering around. And...
So they take my blood sugar and it just says hi. And the guy goes, hello.
Yeah.
So they put it in there and they drive me to the hospital. And they put me in the ICU because they need to monitor like how much I'm peeing and all that stuff. So it's in the ICU. I'm watching King of the Hill on my iPod Touch, which I'm actually wearing a King of the Hill shirt right now.
Yeah.
Hello to you too, you fly swat and sissy.
Yeah, I love cotton. So I'm sitting there, dude. I'm just like, dude, the first thing I said to the EMT, I'm like, this is going to sound really stereotypical. And he's like, what? I go, I need to pee really bad. He's like, yeah, we probably do. So I'm sitting in the ICU in a bed, and I'm just watching, like binge watching King of the Hill. And dude, it's crazy. There's a guy who came through, like through a windshield. There's all these people. I'm just sitting there like, can Jesus. I leave? And dude, so I went to Presbyterian, which is part of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC. That month, they'd just been named the top acute diabetic care hospital in the world. Acute, yeah, for diabetes.
Nice.
That's lucky.
The lady comes over to me and goes, hi. She introduces herself. She's like, I'm your doctor. I was like, hi, nice to meet you. She goes, this is my first day in the ICU. And I was like, that's not, yeah. Right. I was like, that's not reassuring. And she goes,
right.
She goes, your case was obviously like randomly assigned to me as it comes to the door. And she goes, I've spent the last 25 years as an ICU nurse, as an ICU doctor in children's ICU. So I'm the only doctor who's actually seen a case of pronounced type 1 diabetes. And like, I'm a religious guy. You guys know I'm like a very openly religious guy. And I'm just like, it's pretty good evidence of God. Like, when he doesn't want to take you, he doesn't want to take you.
Right.
So my dad flies down. My mom can't fly because she has like ear problems. So my dad flies down. And my dad, I'm not joking, has not flown since Jimmy Carter. So he shows up to Logan. He has a little knife in his front pocket cut his peaches and his apples. So they throw that away and they scan his hands. And my dad's a mechanic. He owns a gas station. And so every explosive substance is on his hands. Everything. He ends up missing his flight, which he was sad he missed his flight, but there was like nice rocking chair. He's very nervous. Yeah. He's going to fall asleep watching the planes. He gets down there and like, I have celiac disease. I have type 1. I'm on a what do they call it? Insulin schedule.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't have to do any of that.
No good.
So, insulin schedule, you can only eat so much food. And so my dad just keeps going down to the cafeteria and ordering like 4 or 5 hot dogs with no buns. And I'm just sitting there just pounding hot dogs because it's like protein. I can eat as much hot dogs as I want. I end up gaining like 60 pounds in like 45 days. It was pretty crazy. Yeah, but it's so the doctor's like comes over to me and she's like, "You have
still wicked skinny though."
I'm like 200. I got up to 225. I used to
60
work.
Pounds. That would have put you at like 180 at 6'4".
Yeah, that's not too big. I got up to like 225.
That's not big, no.
Like I worked out a ton because it was cool. I went from like not being able to walk up a flight of stairs to like squatting 385. So like. I think I got my deadlift to like a little north of 5. Then I met Tiffany and I was in shape and I trapped her. She thought I would stay in shape. I didn't. So I got her. That's her fault. but before
you lose her, we should probably wrap this thing up then and let you get back to her.
Yeah, right. But yeah, dude, it was crazy because they told me, like, you have a superhuman ability to hold ketones because you should have died. They were like, my A1C was 19.5.
I don't know what that means.
That's like completely
full on diabetic ketoacidosis.
Yeah. No brain damage. Nothing.
You were on death's door.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. The record's like 22.1. So I was like, damn, if they just let me hold out for another couple months, I would have.
You would have had it.
Yeah. And died.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Wow.
We got any other tariff things or thoughts or anything that we want to say before I wrap this thing up?
No, I mean, I think the episode we did previously talking about how to analyze tariffs and how to talk about tariffs in an applicable manner, you know, using, you know, widely accepted modeling. I think that's the best way. I do think that's the best way to do it. I think what's important as we hear this discussion on tariffs is to understand that tariffs are never an economic a pro-growth economic policy. There's no such thing as a pro-growth tariff. There are tariffs, like we talked about with electric vehicles, like when you have a nation and you know, intentionally manipulating a market in order to drown out a domestic market. Yes, you can have therapeutic tariffs in that standpoint, but you know, that's associated with a marginal social cost. But as you hear more and more dialogue on tariffs, I think it's important to understand that those tariffs are not meant to grow the economy. Let me use the word intended. It does seem those are intended to provoke a response from those nations. And the reason nations have tariffs on us in a lot of cases, it's because those nations are also practicing anti-trade practices. They're not doing something positive. It's not like those nations aren't necessarily benefiting from the consumers of those nations aren't benefiting from putting a tariff on the United States.
Right.
All right. That is political lobbying and protectionism in those other countries that has won and caused those tariffs. So it's not, and the last thing to remember is that it's not country A tariffing country B because it's a trade deficit between country B and country A. It is a bunch of company A's and a bunch of company B's in another country that are trading with each other,
Causing
the imbalance. It's a bunch of individual decision makers. So when you start talking about wanting to reduce trade deficits using tariffs, you're talking about taking choice away from the individuals in reducing the amount of market access. And none of those things propagate the increase of, you know, the increase of market growth. So it's never going to be a pro-growth or pro-business thing to do unless you're the one business in an economy that gets protected by the tariff, and that's just cronyism.
Right. Man, I think you said that just about as well as it could have been said. Really appreciate that, man. Thank you for your time. Thank you for coming down here and doing this, especially on a Valentine's Day, man. Bear, thank you for jumping in here, man, helping me with some of the questions. Thank you, everybody who listened, for sticking around to the very end. Remember, you can show our panelists some love. You can click on those links in the show notes. Eric has his stuff over at theinformaleconomist.com. No capitals. Visit bandoftraderspodcast.com so you can stay up to date with everything related to the show and Vonta Trading to level up your trading. Be back soon with another exciting episode, but till that day, like, share, subscribe, all the things, and have a green week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only, does not constitute financial or investment advice, and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.